Sports Day for Kia. The new Kia Niro electric SUV range has landed. And Red Energy, awarded Canstar's most trusted energy retailer nationally for 2021. That's Red Energy.
7 minutes past six. Hello and welcome to the Monday edition of Sports Day. Sam McClure and Jimmy Bartel with you. We have a huge show coming up. David Noble, the coach of the North Melbourne Footy Club, just about to join us. We're also going to touch base with former Hawthorn great and Port Adelaide great, Sean Burgoyne, who's back at Port Adelaide in a development role. And we just had two amazing chats, Jimmy and myself, a little early, which will go on our podcast. Peter Moody, the trainer of Incentivise, and also Chloe McArdle, fresh off completing not one English Channel swim, but her 44th. Let's just relive a little bit of how special Saturday was, though.
Incentivise races clear. Two lengths in front of Persan, Great House, Nonconformist, Montefilia, followed by Chapada. But Incentivise is coming away. Four lengths in front. And Incentivise, what a star. Won the Caulfield Cup from Nonconformist.
What a star indeed. A great call by Matty Hill. There were stories of plenty at the tracks on Saturday, Jimmy, as we welcome you. Nature Strip was one of them. Mask Crusader coming from about 10th to finish second in the last 100 metres as well, completely overlooked, but hard to go past Incentivise, not just for the win, but it was how he won.
Absolutely. Came from the widest barrier. A great win for Peter Moody, who's back dominating racing, and Brett Preble as well. So there's stories everywhere, as we find whenever there's a great win in the big Group 1 event, being the Caulfield Cup, one of the big grand slams, if you will, of Australian racing. But
yep.
I'm with you. The chat with Peter Moody and then Chloe McArdle as well. Do yourself a favour. If you have a business or you want to speak to young people, not just young athletes.
Well, you just need to be re-inspired about life.
It's extraordinary.
Yep.
Like, I'll just tell the people, we spent our whole entire time shaking our head in amazement at that young lady.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, you know, you've been a professional athlete for longer than most people, Jimmy, and even you couldn't fathom the mental fortitude.
Just the simple things. It's like, what do you mean? Like,
yeah, and what are you doing for 10 hours while you're swimming?
She did an unassisted swim of 124 kilometres.
Yep, 34 up, 34 back, 34 up again.
It's unbelievable.
No, it is quite unbelievable. And just back on Incentivise, $2.50 right now to win the Melbourne Cup with 57 kilos. And it looks like he's going to be the shortest price Melbourne Cup favourite since Farlap.
Yeah.
In the 20s and 30s.
And the next closest has been since So You Think, which got actually ended up getting a roll by, it was a year American one. So
carrying top weight.
Carrying top weight. That was the other thing. There was a big decision today whether the handicapper, Mr. Carpenter, how much weight he was going to give, whether it actually take it up. If it got 2.5 kilos, it would have been equal with last year's winner, Twilight...
Payment.
Twilight Payment, yep. Sorry. But it'll be about a kilo off that. So it keeps it really interesting, I think, for the Melbourne Cup. And I think the great thing too is this is an Australian horse trained... Yeah, everything brought up here, we can fall back in love with Australian staying. I know we're big on our sprinters and things like that and all the events that go on with that. But, this is one for us all to really get behind. But also, you had the Everest. And how great was the two races almost? We had an hour of unbelievable racing. You mentioned Nature Strip. It solidifies itself as an absolute future Hall of Famer.
Just a freak of a horse.
Yeah. But mind you, as you said, I know it didn't win and... Okay, you can do whatever you want. You know, Ricky Bobby, if you're not first, you're last.
You ain't first, you're last.
Hey, go back and watch Mask Crusader.
Last 150 is just extraordinary.
I showed you. Last 40 seconds, you only need to go back. Just watch a yellow cap. It just weaves its way through the field.
Yeah, and I thought Eduardo ran a huge race as well.
Yeah, it's good for racing. We're all excited about it. Hopefully we get some people back.
Well, so I was going to talk to you about that as well. And David Noble from North Melbourne Fans just about to join us. What were your emotions on Saturday and Sunday? I went through the whole range of it. Saturday, I was sitting there loving the fact that we had great racing on, but then you see the people in Sydney at the Everest walking around with relative freedom, you feel a little bit flat again. And then Sunday, you wake up and you hear this announcement that we're actually going to get more freedoms earlier than we thought.
Well, the sportsman came out in me. I almost had the cliche line to myself, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Like, because we've been in lockdown for so long, You just, well, I can't do much about it.
Well, you become reconditioned to it, which is one of the more dangerous things I think that's happened out of this pandemic.
That's well put. Yeah. It'll come back and things like that. But there's a lot of things in our world that's got to open up as well.
No, that's right. But the football journalist in me all weekend.
Well, we talk sports. We love
sports.
That's
right. Yeah. But it got me thinking, if it is Richmond Carlton, which we assume it'll be, March whenever, are we going to have 100,000 there? Is the world going to move on that quickly?
That's a great point.
Because Richmond and the MCG and the whole footy community has been, like so many other industries, besieged by this pandemic.
Well, it's a great topic you raise.
If we can have this thought that we might actually be able to walk down Swan Street to the MCG, get off the tram, however you get there, the train, and walk into 100,000 people, that just seems so foreign to us.
Were we even clear yet what happens with teams and players?
No, we saw that there was a positive test with a Richmond AFLW player, and vaccines are going to be a huge talking point for professional athletes all across the world, but particularly, you know, as we concentrated on AFL football heading into next season.
But what if everyone at the club is double vaccinated? Just I'm saying hypothetically, but someone still tests positive.
What then?
Yeah. So we heard from the Players Association, we heard from the AFL about
still a bit of a minefield, isn't it?
Yeah. The AFLW competition's about to kick off.
Yep.
We need some answers, please. Call the people that you know.
Well, one that this show knows very well is David Noble. He's dealt with plenty of minefields during his time in footy, and he joins us live on Sports Day as the coach of North Melbourne. David, welcome.
G'day, Sam. G'day, Jimmy. Some great conversations there you guys are having. Some interesting points.
I was just going to say, David, this time of the year as a coach, I'm sure you'd be thinking about, you know, injury prevention, what we're going to play like next season. Are we going to have a fit and healthy list, getting new players in, old players out? What part of your mind is concentrating on other things, like things you never thought you'd be thinking about, like vaccines?
I'm double vax, so I think we've got a high percentage of our club that's vaxed as well. But the thing that I guess I finished off last year missing, and you know your commentary just then, Sammy, about getting, you know, 100,000 people to the G on our first round next year just really excites us to get our fans collectively. But, you know, for us to get our fans back to come and cheer for us, it's something that we extremely missed, this year. And to have that picture and, that goal and aspiration for us as an industry to have 100,000 people at round one would just be bloody fantastic.
Dave, we'll get to, I guess, all the coaching lingo and speak, but you spent a lot of time in administration, so I'm going to use one of the great words from sporting administration. Have you any clearer on the protocols ahead if something, like if everyone's double vaxxed but you still get a positive? Have you got any indication from the AFL or the Players Association what would happen if even a double vaxxed player tested positive?
Not at this stage, Jimmy. The only thing that I would think is that, you know, the way that it shifted this year particularly, you know, we didn't necessarily have to go into small groups as much as we did the year before. So you would like to think that, you know, maybe with some of that rapid testing, the double vax, as you say, it's, still around the world. There are people that are still, contracting the virus, but obviously not at the level of intensity, you know, if you're not. So I guess we'll just have to play that out as we go, mate. But, I think the governments are trying to get on top of it, being able to get people out of lockdown, in, particularly in Victoria, that's been there for a long period of time, is something that I'm sure everybody's aspiring to get out in a couple of days' time.
Well, let's talk about some bit more exciting stuff in footy. The professor of football, Glenn Luff, he had his phone ringing off the hook to try and get that number one draft pick, especially from the Crows, because they had a South Australian kid right under their nose just dominating SANFL footy. Horne Francis, was there ever a consideration to move the number one pick on?
In my old role, maybe. In my new role, no. from a business perspective, you've got to listen. You know, I think it's just, one, it's... if it's in the interest of the club to consider something, mate, then someone's prepared to put something, you know, compelling in front of you. It probably wasn't from either of the two clubs. I'd have to say that wasn't anything that was extremely compelling for us to go, oh yeah, look, that's something that we need to take to the board and consider. From a coach, he's a fantastic player. We're looking forward that if we don't do any dealing in that period of time between now and the draft, we'd love to consider him, I think, at the top end of the draft.
What about the other side of footy? They're the new players coming in, old players going out. It's never easy. Sean Attlee, no. Trent Dumont, Tom Campbell, Charlie Ham, all being told they wouldn't be offered new deals. Can I just ask you about Sean? 234 games for the club, David. And I guess relative to that, you're an outsider coming in. How difficult is that conversation? All delistings, I'm sure, are really tough. But a guy that's played that many games and has been part of the fabric of the footy club for as long as he has been, are you able to take us inside that conversation?
Yeah, as you say, Sam, they're extremely tough regardless. I mean, you're taking away, you know, people's aspirations and dreams in a lot of cases. And Sean's been, you know, an enormous stalwart of our football club and a very well-loved, player. Particularly internal from a player's perspective, highly valued, highly rated. Look, without going into, I guess, the intimate details, I think it's those conversations that you need to have, you know, ongoing through the year. You can't afford, I don't think, as a person or an individual to get to a point that it becomes, you know, just a shock or you blindside someone from that side of things. So, yeah, there were some ongoing discussions, with myself and Sean in regards to where things were laying. We have to make some changes. We need to continue to grow the list. There's a level of unluckiness in some of those players, and there's a number of them across the competition at every club, mate, where they cycle out of contract, unfortunately, at the wrong time. And, you know, so there's a little bit of that as well. And then there's some tough decisions that we have to make in the assessment of where we're going, how our list needs to build and how we're going to maintain, you know, opportunity for guys to come through. So there's a number of different elements that go into the overall decision. But, yeah, Sean and Trent, you know, have been fantastic players for our football club for a long period of time.
Dave, you're using a bit of American terminology, your depth chart. Off the back of his year last year, I know no one's guaranteed any position. They're still going to put in the work, but Larky looks to be the key forward there. But you look at your rucks / key forwards, big bananas around 200 centimetres tall. You got young Charlie Cobden. Goldstein was fantastic, and we know he likes to play predominantly ruck. Edwards, the mid-season draft, and then Coleman Jones comes across.
Yeah.
One of these guys is going to probably have to serve a longer apprenticeship as a forward than a ruck.
Yeah, that's probably true. I think the aspect that we liked last year was the fact that every time Goldie went actually forward, he kicked goals. Yep. His time forward for the number of shots on goal, he was probably behind Larks and probably in front of Cam. He was probably our most effective forward. He's awkward to match up on. You know, there aren't too many teams that have got two defenders that are, you know, a couple of hundred centimetres, so it throws another element to the opposition. He's quite mobile, down there too, Jim. He's, you know, he's good below his knees. Yep. His defence isn't too bad. So, yeah, maybe the transition, for us at the moment, and we know CJ and Tristan can both play forward, so we feel like we're building some arsenal down there with Larks and Cam, you know, of guys that can actually add some aerial power to our offense.
Oh, I forgot about Sherry too, because obviously all the wheeling and dealing going on there with the Saints. But even your experienced players, like we know Zeeble settled in well down back. Hopefully, we see a fully fit Ben Cunnington. But it's a good sign that Simpkin wins the best and fairest, isn't it? Like that young group coming through as well, that he was able to put together a fantastic season along with, obviously, Davies Uniacke.
Yeah, I think in the top 10, mate, we had five or six of that next crew, you know, coming through. It was really exciting. But, yeah, Jai had a great year. He learned a heap You know, we challenged him hard internally. You know, as a leader in our leadership group, he took responsibility for stoppages at times. You know, Ben wasn't there early with that concussion. He wasn't there late. And he stepped into the breach when Ben wasn't, you know, with us last year as well. So he's continued to evolve in that space. I think he learnt the balance of that inside-outside role really well. He took some really key opposition midfielders for us from time to time as well. So yeah, he had a fantastic year, and it was, as you said, not so much, I don't think it's a changing of the guard, so to speak, but it's sort of in that realm, isn't it? It's that new, fresh, vibrant youth that we've got coming through that showed some extreme excitement and some real genuine speed for us.
What have you learnt yourself? What have you learned about yourself as a coach, David, 12 months in?
I think I've been able to not worry too much about the small things, Sammy. I think, you know, we can sort of move on. You know, having support, I think, within your coaching group has been really important. You know, the guys that keep you well-rounded, I think, in the sense of, you know, who needs to have a conversation, where are we at, are we on track, are we not on track, are we, you know, going too hard within our meetings. So, you know, the group of coaches that we've assembled in the last 12 months have been fantastic. We've got, you know, great experience, we've got some youth, we've got some versatility guys that have come from different clubs. So that's been important, and I think, you know, I've just got to be patient. You know, in I think as coaches, we're all in a hurry, you know, to gain success, and we've just got to do it methodically. We've got to do it the right way, and, you know, that it'll come. Success will come.
Yep, and I think most North Melbourne supporters would agree that you are going about it the right way. Hopefully some exciting times ahead for North Melbourne. David, really appreciate your time as always. We'll chat to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure.
David Noble there, coach of North Melbourne. Tom McDonald has had some really interesting things to say to Channel 9 News about vaccine mandates. We're going to get to those after this.
I'm vaccinated, and most players would have been. But to be honest, I think it's ethically wrong to force people into a medical procedure.
That was Tom McDonald on Channel 9 News with Ed and Woolley just a few minutes ago. Ethically wrong to force people into a medical procedure. And that's coming from someone who is already fully vaccinated. Yeah. That's fascinating. And I believe that he's the first player to speak out publicly about that.
Yeah, you'd love him to extend a bit more about that, because it sort of raises a few more questions, like, as in, did you just get it because you were forced to continue to train and play? If you had the option not to, would you have not done it? So, yeah, would have loved to hear a little bit more from Tom, but I like when players speak their mind. You and I always talk about this off air. We love to hear more from the players and express their personality.
And Tom's always been like that, in fairness. I mean, he's always said exactly what he thinks. Yeah, I mean, without starting the bleeding obvious, that's fascinating that a player is brave enough and candid enough to come out and say, well, yep, I've got it, but I don't think, you know, you should necessarily force people to. I'm with Tom, by the way. I think it's hard to mandate it, but it just becomes really difficult in a team environment. This isn't Novak Djokovic not wanting to get vaccinated. That only affects him and his back pocket and his ability to win slams.
This is my point. The Players Association and the AFL need to come out and make it clear their guidelines, because just all this talk, and you're putting it on players who get door-stopped or they're doing any other interviews.
Everyone's going to be asked about it.
Asked about it. Take the pressure off the players and people involved at the clubs and just make it clear. Like, we've spoken about the NBA Players Association.
Yeah.
They didn't say you had to be vax, double vax, but here are the conditions if you are or if you are not.
Yep. Well, I mean, the AFL have already taken their first baby step in that. Gillon McLachlan said in his opening address at the Brownlow Medal, get vaxxed.
Yeah, but no one cares about what head office does. No one's going along Thursday night to watch Richmond, Melbourne to see the administrators.
No. But of course people care what head office does, because if they mandate it, players have to do it.
But they haven't mandated yet for players yet.
No, but I think that they haven't arrived at their destination, but I think they're in the suburb. And you've got the Victorian government have mandated here for essential workers.
Very difficult to arrive at your suburb at the moment in Victoria. Have you seen the delays going on with the tunnel?
Oh, never a truer point, Jimmy. By the way, for those who don't know, an AFLW player for Richmond has actually tested positive over the weekend. It forced their teammates into isolation. We're on the eve of the AFLW season, and Denny Van Hagen, who's a premiership player with the Crows, has told Adelaide she's not willing to have the COVID vaccine. So we're going to hear more and more of these stories as we get into the depths of the AFLW season and what happens with the positive test on the eve of a game. And we're going to hear more about it as we get deeper into the preseason for the men's competition as well. Stay with us on Sports Day. Jimmy Bartel is here for the hour. We're going to hear from Sean Burgoyne as well, former Hawthorn and Port Adelaide great. This is Sports Day on a Monday. Welcome back to Sports Day. Sean Burgoyne coming up shortly, but before then, it's time for news headlines with Tony Sardio.
Good evening. 34 Victorian police officers and 9 protective services officers have been stood down and directed to take leave after refusing to get vaccinated. Victoria has recorded 1,903 COVID cases in the past 24 hours. 7 people have died. Queensland will be opening up to Victorians from the 17th of December. From that date, quarantine will no longer be required. The Mayor of Banyul has admitted to spending up to $30,000 on Labor Party branch stacking. Rick Garotti has told the ICAC hearing in Melbourne branch stacking was an integral element of Labor Party culture. He's also accused the President of Victoria's Upper House of Parliament, Labor MP Nazi Elesmar, of branch stacking. And police have described a stabbing incident at a Brunswick shopping centre this morning as an unprovoked random attack. A man armed with a knife stabbed a customer and a security guard at the Woolworths at Berkeley Square at around 8 a.m. More news at 7.
Time now for a sports update for Tyre Power, Australia's biggest independent tyre retailer, keeping you safe on the roads. Tyrepower.com.au.
This horse has sort of delivered a fair spanking to most of the local opposition here the last six or 8 weeks. So he's trying to level the playing field at the same time, not take away from this horse's chance. So I thought he was quite harsh on him going into the Caulfield Cup, and then he whacked another kilo and a half on him, so he was right in the Caulfield Cup. So I want to back his confidence to think that he can win the Melbourne Cup.
Peter Moody there talking to us on our podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, it'll be up shortly. Responding to Incentivise now carrying 57 kilos in his Melbourne Cup quest at Flemington the first Tuesday in November. Currently $2.50 Incentivise. Not a whole lot of value there. I think he'd be the shortest favourite since Farlap in the late 20s and early 30s. You never like going near the really short price favourites in Melbourne Cup, particularly when they're carrying a heavy weight, but hard to go past Incentivise at the moment.
Well, just because so much can go wrong. The field's so big, it's such a long race, things like that. But probably the next closest, sort of short favourite in recent times is So You Think, and it got rolled. So, you need so much luck with the Melbourne Cup.
Well, you do. But as you, the point that you made to Peter in that interview, so much can go wrong, but Incentivise, because of this tank that he's got, you almost feel like as long as he has space when he turns, it's going to be so hard to catch him.
Yeah, it can ride on any pace. You just give it some space, as you said, so it doesn't have to follow horses through the race and get that protection that others would need.
Yeah, and he had some, if you go and listen to the interview, some really interesting comments on Brett Prebble and pretty honest about where he's been as a jockey. And I think the terminology he uses that he almost hit rock bottom at a certain point. And back now racing a Caulfield Cup winner. Pretty extraordinary. And West Coast, in quick footy news, has delisted Jared Brander. So pick 13 not that long ago, Jared Brander, now delisted. And Richmond today announcing they re-signed Sydney Stack for next season. Sean Burgoyne to join us live after this. Yes, the great Sean Burgoyne. We could have played a few more of his highlights, but we actually would have had to have extended the show by another 5 hours. 407 games. I know people know who Sean Burgoyne is. We don't need to give him the intro, but he deserves it. Can I just, when I was researching a little bit of Sean's amazing career today, Jimmy. And you're well versed to be able to talk about this, given how many games you've played. 407 games over 20 seasons. And in 15 of those seasons, he polled Brownlow votes. How do you play for 20 years and only have 5 years where you don't poll Brownlow votes?
Well, they would have got it wrong in those 5 years.
100%. I bet you he could go through games and could have played anywhere, which got me thinking and asking the question today. Is there any other player that's played as much as Sean Burgoyne or even half as much? We got to the end of his career. We thought, gee, I wonder what his best position was. Kick 40 goals in his second year as a forward. Kick 40 goals again a few years later in 07 from the midfield.
Yeah, that to me.
Halfback.
I know he's had 20 brilliant years, but is he there yet? Sean, is he on the line yet?
Well, let's find out. Sean Burgoyne, who's got his own book out, that's Silk, which you're going to ask him about, I think he's online. Welcome to you, Sean.
Hey, guys, how are you? I'm waiting for the right time to jump in.
Hey, Sean, I know every player will say a premiership year is their best year, but from a personal satisfaction point of view, do you have a year? Like, I thought one of your 20, the 07 year where you kicked 39, but you're playing as a midfielder, just really
stands out.
You're just having a laugh, really, with the rest of the competition. was that the best?
It's funny because I remember, I was All Australian a couple of years before that in 2006 as a non-baller, which I thought I played okay. And then I thought I played better a couple of years later in the year you're mentioning. I thought I played better. All my stats were better. I'd kick 40 goals, whatever it was, being on ball tagged. And some of the feedback I got was my season wasn't as good as the previous year or the year before. So. I reckon about 2007, I think, when I had your great mate Lingy, whenever we played Geelong, and if it wasn't him, it was Maxi Rook trying to rough me up all the time. So it was a mini game within a game back then when I was playing on ball, because each week the opposition tagger would normally try to tag me, and you're trying to play mind games, as you know, when someone comes to you, how to beat those taggers. But that were definitely some of the most challenging years I've had, but most rewarding.
Yeah, they were two big brutes to try and get away from. It's going to be a strange question, but obviously everyone makes a big deal, of course, how you arrived at Hawthorn, you're on the crutches and things like that. In a strange way, did that help add years to your footy because you became even better with your preparation, understanding your body, what you sort of need to do from a week-to-week basis?
Yeah, it did. I thought I was pretty good with my preparation and how professional I was. But then when your career's put on the line and you're told by the surgeon this surgery's either going to help you or you're going to have to retire, then you really, really got to become elite and obsessive about your body, which is exactly what I did. The first day I walked into Hawthorn, Andrew Russell, the fitness coach at the time, said, drop your dacks, stand in your jocks and get on the scales. So I did that. I was standing in my jocks on the scales, and he said, yep, we're going to strip a few kilos off you. So change your diet, your sleep, change your weights program, and mentally we'll get you up and about playing some different roles. So, you know, when it's put to you like that, then it's all in your control, what you can and can't do. So, yeah, that's when I really had to really sharpen the screws in all aspects of my life, to enable me to get onto the footy field.
You're back at Port Adelaide in a wide-ranging off-field role. You've also got the book, Silk, out. What was the favourite part of the book for you, Sean?
Well, I'm very nervous, actually, to be honest, about the book. Okay. I had to be talked into it, to be honest, to do it, because I was just nervous about being critiqued and judged about something other than football.
Yeah.
But I actually just enjoyed the whole... Once I got sitting down with Martin Blake and helped co-write it, I actually really enjoyed just actually the whole journey about, reminiscing about everything, my life as a kid, my father's life, my footy career, and even the rough times in football. When you look back over your journey, the rough times and the times where you got down and you were down and out actually brings a smile to my face, to be honest, because it's just a part of my journey and part of what's helped create me to the person I am today. So actually reminiscing and putting a full stop on my footy career was, quite rewarding.
We mentioned the off-field role at Port Adelaide. What were your day-to-day stuff involve?
Yeah, it's going to be across a few different things. So I'll have a little bit to do with list management. Obviously, Jason Cripps is the list manager, so probably working with him a little bit. Government and corporate relations, there's a number of sponsors they've got, and trying to raise some money to extend the club. I'll be the Indigenous liaison officer with the Indigenous boys there, and just some leadership and mentoring stuff. So there's a number of things there. Once we get in there, we'll tweak things to see, this role's going to, need this amount of time and that amount of time. At the moment, it's across a few different things, and it's something that I'm really looking forward to, learning something other than footy.
Now, the day I retired, I reckon my phone had about 45 local football clubs wanting one game or two games or three games.
Only 45?
Have you committed anywhere for three games?
I've actually had a couple of phone calls. One coming from Darwin to see if I wanted to play up there. Actually, two from Darwin. I've been up to play. I said no thanks. I do want to die in the sun up there. Then a couple of country leagues. That'll be hot, mate. Running around up there in the MT. It's not my go. Potentially go back home to Mallee Park and play one game there. That's about it, really. But I'm looking forward to actually going and watch the amateurs play and having a beer, sitting in a deck chair, to be honest.
Yeah, finally the stress of not having to rock up every week, Sean, and put your body through the torment that it did for 20 years won't be there. Hey, can I just ask you about the end of this year? A weird one in so many ways for the Hawks. Now that you can be honest with us, when it was originally announced, the handover plan, did you sit there, Sean, and think, hang on, I know Clarko. I don't know if I can see this happening.
Yeah, well, I think everyone thought that, to be honest. Fair to say, we, as players, in all honesty, we didn't know what was going on. We'd rock up the training, and when we, we're Waverley situated in Melbourne, and there's never any media out there, but when you rock up the training and there's media already waiting in the stands, something's happening. So that's literally when we would find out. We'd rock up the training, like, oh, what's going on here? And then we'd come in after training, there'd be a meeting, and say, all right, guys, this is what's happened. And so none of the players actually knew what was going on that last 6 months, because obviously the decisions are made upstairs. But those decisions do have an impact on the playing group from day to day, because it's something you can't avoid. You talk about it in the change rooms and after games, before games or whatever, because it's in your face and it's an everyday topic. So, yeah, to be honest, I couldn't really shed any much light on that, because you just found out when the reporters were actually breaking the news.
What kind of coach do you think Sam Mitchell will be?
Yeah, he's it's going to be interesting to see. He's always been a very smart football player, meticulous in his habits.
Yep.
So I think he'll be able to get his point across very easily to the playing group. But we'll just see how he goes. He's a young coach. I think the way things have happened over the last 6 months, it's going to be interesting to see how he goes, because obviously he's taken over from the greatest Hawthorn coach there was. So big shoes to fill, but he'll do things his way, and time will tell whether it's the right choice or not.
Sean, I know the role we spoke about, you'll be doing bits and pieces, but was that an option for you, or you seriously considered going into coaching yourself? Because there would have been offers for you to be in it, like just a full-time assistant coach.
Yeah, there was there were some offers and people ringing up and speaking to my manager about coaching. I gave it a bit of a thought, but at this time, I've just figured, assistant coaches, they put in hours and hours and hours of work in behind the scenes to get ready for not only training, or not only games, but training. So I thought it'd be a good time just to step back and just do some footy ops admin stuff, in a footy club, and then we'll wait and see at the end of this year whether that's something I want to stay in or get back into coaching. But at the moment, I'm just excited about doing something new other than football.
And from the man himself, don't worry about me and Jimmy debating it. What was your best position?
I probably like to think on ball. When I had a good knee, I'd like to think I'd played some good footy there.
Sean, I think you played some good footy with one good knee as well.
I know. So, but in all honesty, I actually really enjoyed the challenge later on in my career, because
yep.
we sat down with Clarko and said, well, if you're going to play on ball, your shoulders are going to be cooked, your back's going to get cooked, knees and ankles, and the rigors of the game is going to cook you. So he said, let's play back, forward and mid, and which I really enjoyed that challenge. That from game to game, and then obviously from quarter to quarter, because that's what happened in real time. But I I think that's one of the things that kept me going later on into my career, is that challenge each week of getting up for the team. And then when the team needed me to change my role, then mentally get through that and then actually perform. So I think that was a real big big turn in my career of going later on into my late 30s.
Sean, such a privilege to have you on. We could talk for hours to you. Port Adelaide are very lucky to have you back. The AFL is still lucky to have you involved in the game. I'm sure you'll be involved for a long time yet. So good luck with the next phase of your career and your life. And we're all looking forward to reading your book, Silk.
No worries, guys. Thanks for having me.
Sean Burgoyne there, the great Sean Burgoyne. There'll be plenty of great stories in that book, Silk, as well. Great stories about Choco, early days, Clarko early days, Clarko late days.
Playing with his brother, what a combination, and Brendan Lay.
Jeez. How good was... Peter was underrated, I reckon, you talk about the Burgoynes.
People always talk about great midfielders in the last 20 years, obviously West Coast and Brisbane and even the Hawks and my Cats teammates. But you forget about that Port Adelaide one.
Poor.
Brendan, the two Burgoynes, Cars.
Oh, the Cars as well. More sports after this.
So I ended up getting severe hypothermia. They pulled me out of the water. Apparently, I don't remember, but apparently I was swimming with one arm and I wasn't following their instructions. And they're like, oh my God, she's lost it. Let's pull her out. By the time they got me to hospital and the doctor examined me, the doctor said to my crew, if you'd left her in there 30 minutes longer, she would have been dead. So people have died swimming in the English Channel. Often the reason given from the coroner is cardiac arrest, but they don't know specifically, you know, was it from severe hypothermia leading to cardiac arrest? Was it like drowning from becoming unconscious then leading to cardiac arrest? And even one guy washed up in Belgium a few days after he was lost whilst crossing the English Channel. So for me, hypothermia is what worries me the most.
That's the voice of Chloe McArdle, open water swimmer. Just broke the world record swimming the English Channel for the 44th time. If you got a spare 15 minutes, wherever you get your podcast, iTunes, Spotify, it's there. Our chat with her is she is nothing short of extraordinary.
And fascinating. There's
just a little bit there, Jimmy, of nearly, literally swimming herself to death.
Yeah, extraordinary, fascinating. It still leaves me with so many questions.
Yeah. And, you know, someone like you who would have listened to all of the best motivational speakers in your time as a Cat and a player, and you were bewildered by that.
Yeah. I just don't know how. She's so mentally tough. Extraordinary woman.
She's a freak.
Yeah.
In the best way possible.
Yeah,
she's
absolutely
unbelievable. I'm not sure we'll see anything like it again, to be honest, from someone like Chloe. Go and listen to the podcast. Enjoy the rest of your Monday evening. Jimmy and I will see you tomorrow.
Incentivised races clear. Two lengths in front of Persan, Great House, Nonconformist, Montefilia, followed by Chapada. But Incentivised is coming away. Four lengths in front. And Incentivised, what a star. Won the Caulfield Cup from Nonconformist.
What a star indeed. Hello and welcome to the hour. Sam McClure and Jimmy Bartel with you. It's very rare that we start an hour with a piece of audio, Jimmy. Usually just like to welcome everyone in, soft build-up, but such was the excitement, and you could hear in Matty Hill's voice, what a moment for Incentivised in the Caulfield Cup. I was off the couch running around the house in lockdown. One of the more exciting things I've ever seen.
Yeah, I was in awe. And you know,
I think we still all are.
Yeah, it was so dominant. It was pure. We know we love to see close finishes and photo finishes and things like that. But sometimes when something absolutely smashes the field, it's just pure in sport.
Now he goes to the Melbourne Cup where he'll carry 57 kilos. His trainer joins us on the line, Peter Moody. Welcome to you, Moods. Congratulations.
Afternoon, boys. Thanks. It was a terrific day. You know, the horse did us proud and he did himself proud, didn't he? He was very dominant.
Moods, Jimmy here. You're normally a straight shooter when we see you on TV and all the different media coverage that we get, but you're a bit more emotional than usual in the post-race.
Yeah, well, it was a special one, and it's one of the big races of the calendar, obviously, and at Caulfield, a track that I had a lot of success at over the years, and I've won sort of all the majors there over the years without sort of ever figuring in the cups frame whatsoever. So it was pretty special, and to come back after you know 4 or 5 years away, you know, in our first full season to be able to win it, that was that was pretty gratifying also.
I know you mentioned Caulfield, and you said you've trained over 2,000 winners there, you know, heaps. You know the course well, inside out, every blade of grass. The weight added to incentivise, plus going to Flemington, again, a different shaped track. What would be the big thing you'll focus on for incentivise?
Oh, listen, I think he's probably going to be better suited back at Flemington because he's a horse that he's sort of a bit knock-kneed and he toes out in front, his front leg. So he's going to be better suited on the bigger, flatter tracks with the longer straight because, as you would have seen on Saturday, sort of when he was turning, he sort of drops a bit and loses momentum. But when he gets in a sort of long, flat, straight line, that's when he builds momentum and sort of grinds his opposition away. So at Flemington, I think he'll be better suited. Obviously, it's a challenging weight, the 57 kilos, but he's probably earned that. But, you know, bearing in mind, you know, he's got to give weight to something like Very Elegant. She was unlucky in the Cup last year, and she's a 9-times Group 1 winner. And he only gets 1 kilo off the reigning champion in Twilight Payment. So it's going to be no easy task. We're not kidding ourselves. But, you know, we've got the horse in the right vein of form. He's racing extremely well. And the way he's run through the line and finished off his last couple of races at 2,000 and 2,400, it's starting to give us good heart that he should see out a strong 3,200, which is always a question mark on these horses.
Incentivise, great story. You're a great story. You're back winning Group 1s. But Brett Prebble as well, his ride was faultless, you know, coming from the widest barrier and then absolutely smashing him. He must be pretty happy for him. We saw the emotion between you two post-race as well.
Yeah, well, we've both been a bit down in our luck probably over the last few years, and I'd like to be down on my luck as much as Brett. I'd like to have his bank balance, but you know, he was still earning extremely well, even though he mightn't have been at the top of the tree. But listen, he's a great jockey, sort of champion jockey here before he went overseas, and he spent many years in Hong Kong sort of honing his skills against the best in the world. And obviously came home, and I think by his own recognition, you know, he's, you know, probably mindset and attitude needed to change, and you've probably really seen that in him now, and that's probably a bit of the emotion side of it as well. You know, he was probably as cocky and as out there as anyone, and then all of a sudden you hit rock bottom, and not rock bottom, but you sort of struggle for rides, and then, you know, you wonder why, and I don't think they ever ride bad, but maybe people sort of think, oh, well, you know, attitude and mannerism and, you know, whether he wanted to really be there. But I think by going to the bush and working hard and really showing people that he wanted to climb back to the top of the mountain, you know, he's been justly rewarded this spring with 5 Group 1s.
He certainly has. What an amazing comeback, as you just talked about. So we know plenty about Incentivise, the racehorse moods. What's he like as a horse?
Listen, he's no oil painting. He's a nice horse, but you'd walk past plenty before you pulled up and looked at him. And like I said a bit earlier, you know, he hasn't got the best wheels under him. But by crikey, he can move those legs pretty quick and he can sustain a strong gallop for a long way. You know, as Brett sort of rightly said in a lot of interviews, a lot of horses would out-sprint him, but they can't maintain that strong grinding gallop for as long as he can. He's obviously got an unbelievable aerobic capacity, and I've seen that here at home in the training. I don't have to do a lot with him, and you very seldom ever see him have a blow or be stressed. I'm yet to see him, you know, ever be stressed by a piece of work or a race. You know, he just sort of takes it all in his stride. So he's a supreme sort of equine athlete for sure.
So saying that, Moods, you know, obviously the Melbourne Cup, there's all sorts of trouble. You run into back of horses everywhere, and we see with the Caulfield Cup coming from the wide barrier. Is it a horse where the instructions to the jockey is, don't worry where you are on the field, just keep it out of trouble because it can sustain that long gallop?
Yeah, well, he's a horse that races in a forward position. Usually he goes at a nice gallop, so he makes his own luck. So that takes a lot of the bad luck out of the equation straight away. And then obviously on Saturday when he drew the outside barrier, he had no traffic around him, you know, and no one dictating to him. So, you know, even when he in that mile race and the 2,000 metre race at Flemington, when he drew low numbers, he was able to heel up and hold a spot. But you hope not to have to do that too often. You know, you'd rather just come out and let it and build into the race. And that was the fortunate scenario on Saturday. And when you start the Melbourne Cup, you start sort of down at the 1,000-metre mark there at Flemington. You got a good 5 furlong run to the first turn. So probably regardless of where he draws, you probably don't want to draw too low on him again, but it'll just allow him to get into a nice free-flowing action and give Brett the opportunity to put him wherever he wanted, you know?
How nervous were you about what weight Greg Carpenter was going to give him? And did you think about sort of delivering his favourite bottle of scotch or maybe a nice drop of Penfolds just on the front door?
Oh, listen, Greg Carpenter's a world-class handicapper and he's very, very good at his job and I respect his opinion. And, you know, you sort of take heart and delight out of when they do penalise him because he thinks he's that bloody good. But then at the same time, you don't want to sort of give too much weight away to the opposition. And, you know, it's Greg's job to try and even the field up. That's what handicap racing's all about. You know, this horse has sort of delivered a fair spanking to most of the local opposition here the last six or eight weeks. So he's trying to level the playing field at the same time, not take away from this horse's chance. So I thought he was quite harsh on him going into the Caulfield Cup, and then he's now he whacked another kilo and a half on him, so he was right in the Caulfield Cup. So I want to back his confidence to think that he can win the Melbourne Cup.
Moods, with a limited amount of international horses and, you know, the Raiders, as we love to call them, they're coming for these big races. Has it, in a strange way, come at a good time to allow us to fall in love with some of our own stars for the big major races this year?
Yeah, well, for sure. And this bloke's a bit unusual because you got to remember a lot of those foreign horses that do come are Australian-owned and people have invested a lot of money in that. So, you know, they deserve everything they can get. But this horse is a solely sort of homegrown product raised up on the Darling Downs there at Queensland and owned by a Queenslander, you know, a New South Welshman and a Victorian. And you know, whatever he earns or wins is going to be reinvested back into the industry here for sure and certain. So that's a great point. But to have that homegrown product is tremendous. And you'll still find that probably two-thirds to three-quarters of the field, even if not greater, are going to be international bred horses. Even though only a couple of them are probably flowing out here for the race this year. You know, it's Australia's race or it's Australasia's race. You know, it's an open handicap, so you're always, you know, grateful for the interest that the international raiders probably create on the world stage. But at the end of the day, it's our race. You know, they're welcome to come if they want, but we don't have to roll out a red carpet for the bastards.
No, we don't. Hey, Jimmy, when you were playing in your peak, what did you used to have post-game? Was it a can of Coke or pasta or get the electrolytes back in?
A packet of chips and a white choc Magnum.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, Moods, I was listening to you today and you know, you talked about the fact that Incentivise took 24 to 36 hours to really get over the race. It just got me thinking today, What does a horse, what do they act like when they've just been put through one of the more rigorous tests in their careers? They go through a race, that 24 hours, and what do you do as a trainer to help them through it?
Oh, listen, they're very much the same as human athletes and that, you know, that different horses recover and relax and get back into routine very quick. Others take a few days to really bounce and get a bit of ping in their step. And I'm sure Jimmy would sort of say, you know, in his years there at Geelong, you know, he would have seen some blokes, you know, he'd shake his head probably in disbelief of how some blokes come through a game and then other blokes would really struggle to pick themselves up in a week or a fortnight's time after a real grind. And the horses are no different. You've got to treat them as individuals. And we go through all the similar routines of massages and ice baths and beach and you know, you sort of lift them to a peak and then you've got to sort of let them come back and relax again and then slowly build up and start warming up and stretching and going again. You know, the comparisons in all sort of athletes, you know, I don't care if it's equine, canine or bloody human or whatever, are very, very similar, you know.
So how did you celebrate? It's a bit difficult with the lockdown and everything like that, but how did you treat yourself on Saturday night?
Fish and chips and a couple of stubs with the girls at home. That was about it. Not much we can do at this day and age. We didn't sneak out and break the rules, but we got to take the Caulfield Cup home and get plenty of photos with it. The girls had a ball, and last time I went to bed and I saw them, they were complaining that they'd run out of champagne sitting in the bar, so they enjoyed it. So that was the main thing.
Well done. We enjoyed watching, and let's hope that if and when Incentivise crosses the line first in the Melbourne Cup carrying 57 kilos... you can have a slightly bigger party because you'll deserve it, Moods. It's been a great journey. It's not over yet. And good luck for the next couple of weeks.
Thanks, boys. Have a great one.
You too. Peter Moody there, trainer of Incentivise, and one of the great interviews as well in the horse racing industry. Honest, upfront, always available. Great friend of the show as well. We're going to chat to Chloe McArdle. That's the woman that I asked you about last week, Jimmy.
Unbelievable.
Broken the record, 43rd English Channel swim. You and I still actually can't get our heads around how you could swim 34 kilometres in open water. She's done it 43 times. So she's going to join us next. Welcome back to Sports Day. We're here for Red Energy, Canstar's most trusted energy retailer, and for Wilson Homes. They believe in great design, so you love being home. Chloe McArdle is a name that everyone listening should know. Now, if you haven't, well, you should. The 36-year-old Aussie just completed her 44th crossing of the English Channel a little after 2 o'clock on Friday afternoon, eclipsing the previous record held by British swimmer Alison Streeter. Chloe's joining us on the line to tell us her story. Welcome, Chloe.
Hi, guys.
Now, Chloe, you're speaking to a journalist and a former professional athlete. So my first question to you is, what on earth do you think about when you're swimming all that way in open water?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There are so many hours to kill out there. I've got a few different strategies. At least for the first few hours, I'm trying to find a rhythm, because when you're out there, usually there's a little bit of chop and waves, and you try and balance yourself. I try and have an efficient stroke to maximize my movement forward and minimize how much time I'm taking. And then I'm also trying to keep an exact distance from the boat of 2 to 3 meters, because if I start going out or coming in, then I'm zigzagging across the English Channel, which, as you can guess, is going to add like kilometers to my trip. So that's the first few hours. And I've got a few strategies. One of them actually is visualizing the successful finish. And that's what I do when I'm in a really bad place. And I go forward in the future and I think about, what does it look like? What does it feel like? What does it taste like? And then I go through that emotional state of actually finishing it. And if I'm in a really bad spot, that's a great trick I had to just draw myself out of that bad spot.
Chloe, it's Jimmy Bartelli. There's so many factors that we haven't even started to think about. Of course, you can't just rock up to the English Channel and go, I'm going to swim that today. When's the perfect conditions for you to do it? And temperature? Wouldn't it be freezing?
Mm.
Yeah, surprisingly, there's a waiting list to do such a difficult and horrible swim.
Really?
And I book most of my positions 2.5 to 3 years in advance. So there's a lot of logistics behind the scenes. There's no perfect day as such that we can predict in advance. Some days are definitely better than others, but that's completely random. So we're talking about wind, right? Mm. But in terms of water temperature, there's a little bit more predictability. So the season starts in early July. It ends usually the first few days of October. And so what that is that's midsummer over here going into the start of autumn. So the water temperature peaks are late summer. So that's the last week of August, first week of September, about then. So a lot of swimmers try and swim around that time. But interestingly, August is known as the windiest month in the channel. So those that are trying to get a slightly better water temperature often have to deal with more fickle weather or worse waves. So really, there's never a good time to swim the English Channel.
Chloe, I'm always fascinated by athletes like yourself who just do extraordinary things. It just blows the mind when you think English Channel. But you've also swam the record, the longest unassisted ocean swim, 124 kilometres in the Bahamas. I'm always fascinated by training. So, you know, we go down the pool and we're puffed and exhausted if we swam a K and we're holding on every 50 metres and hopefully it's a 25-metre pool.
Oh, speak for yourself.
But how do you train for 124-kilometre unassisted swim?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because no one had done anything on the distance before I did it. So there was no model to go on, no one to ask. And if I trained like I would normally train, which is doing higher volume than the actual distance, then I would just kind of like train myself into a hole of injury or burnout, psychological, physical. So I didn't train like I normally would. I actually trained like under that weekly volume distance. So Well, there was one week I actually did 130 kilometres. But besides that week of training of that volume, I was sitting at about 80 kilometres, which sounds fairly conservative considering that event was 124. But if I trained any more, then I would have been too injured or unwell to actually attempt that swim. That was a warm water swim. It was in the Caribbean. So I didn't need to do cold water training like I do for the English Channel. It's something very specific for cold water marathons. You need to train literally in cold water. So that's like Melbourne, middle of winter, or Sydney, middle of winter, in Manly Dam, which gets cold. So the Caribbean one, basically, I didn't think I could train for it. And I got to the point when I was out there where I was broken and had to just swim through a broken state.
Chloe, what's the most dangerous thing when you swim? And what would be the prickliest situation you've gotten yourself into during your time?
Well, interestingly, people think sharks are probably my biggest worry or my biggest fear or biggest chance of dying. But it's been box jellyfish in the Caribbean that have nearly killed me, and also severe hypothermia in the English Channel. So in 2011, I was attempting to be the first Aussie to complete a triple non-stop crossing of the English Channel. Yeah. So that's get into England, swim to France, get out, swim back to England, get out, swim back to France, non-stop, 102 kilometres. So I didn't have enough body fat on me, so like fat around my organs to delay the onset of hypothermia. So I ended up getting severe hypothermia. They pulled me out of the water. Apparently, I don't remember, but apparently I was swimming with one arm and I wasn't following their instructions. And they're like, oh my God, she's lost it. Let's pull her out. By the time they got me to hospital and the doctor examined me, the doctor said to my crew, if you'd left her in there 30 minutes longer, she would have been dead. So people have died swimming the English Channel. Often the reason given from the coroner is cardiac arrest, but they don't know specifically, you know, was it from severe hypothermia leading to cardiac arrest? Was it like drowning from becoming unconscious then leading to cardiac arrest? And even one guy washed up in Belgium a few days after he was lost whilst crossing the English Channel. So for me, hypothermia is what worries me the most.
So, Chloe, I'm fascinated by all of this. People that achieve greatness in whether it's sport or another aspect of life, and they do these, forgive me for using this word, do these crazy things like you're doing, but they come from position or an experience of pain or trauma. I've read quite a lot of your interviews that you've done across your time, and I think you said in one of them that your biggest weapon that you have is your mind. Where does that mental strength come from?
Yeah, you see, you can train to swim the English Channel once, twice, or, you know, attempt twice or three times, and be physically absolutely amazingly fit, just like an elite swimmer. Like I train with national level swimmers, so I've got that pace and I just stretch it a bit further and drop the pace a bit. But the mind is really the secret to marathon swimming, because unless you can convince yourself to keep stroking forward, no matter how fast, how strong, how experienced you are, your body will not follow unless your mind takes you there first. So although I believe training is really important, and I coach people as well to swim the channel, so I get them training, I also set them really hard swim camps so that I nearly break them on the swim camps. So when it comes to the English Channel and they're breaking, they actually go, oh, yeah, well, I've actually been somewhere here before and got through it. So the mind element is huge. I've dealt with quite a lot of trauma in my adult life from domestic violence, but that hasn't really shaped me as an athlete. I was a very determined kid. I just wanted to be really good at something. And then when I was 19, I wanted to be the best in the world at something. So I had a drive that no one could talk me out of. My parents were very unsupportive. They kicked me out of home. They're like, you can do whatever you want with your life, but don't expect us to help you. So I was literally financially independent whilst trying to get through uni and train as an elite athlete, which is really hard. But those hard times just reinstilled the fact that I really earned this. I've deserved everything I get. I've worked super hard. Nothing's really been given to me. I don't get support from Swimming Australia at all. So it's been a super hard journey. So whenever things get tough, I just remind myself of what I've had to go through just to get opportunities. And, you know, that's a driving force for me as well. I can use that as motivation.
Chloe, yeah, nearly every sport, you know, they're measured in certain ways, or there's associations, you know, that hang above them and things like that. What are rules or things that we don't know about with open water swimming? So let's use the channel for an example. Do you have to leave from a certain point? When you did the triple crossing, was it you had to run up onto the sand and come back, or you could do a tumble turn? Is there things we don't know about it, the little technicalities of it?
Yeah, there's some curious things about channel swimming that public may not know. They try and keep the sport really consistent with the first people that swam it back in the late 1800s. So we're not allowed to wear a wetsuit, no shark cage, no flippers, nothing that might keep us warm. We start what's called above the waterline. And then when we enter the water, the marathon officially starts. For the English Channel, we're required to have a support boat there for safety and for feeding. So feeding is liquids and solids. So the liquids and solids usually lowered down every 30 minutes or so. And we tread water while we do that. So we're not allowed on the boat. So there's curious things like we're not allowed to touch the boat. We've got to stay in the water. We're not allowed anyone else to touch us. And then when we get to the other side, we've got to get out on our own steam. We can't be helped out of the water and, again, have to be past the waterline. Now, if we're attempting a double crossing or a triple crossing or something, then we have less than 10 minutes on shore before that next crossing must begin. And the curious thing with this, I think, is that the reason that is because we're not actually entering French shore, French country. We're not officially getting cleared by customs, so that's why we get kicked off the French shore.
You're not getting your passport stamped, I assume.
Yeah, no passport stamp, so you got to get offshore, get back in, keep swimming.
Chloe, it's an incredible story. We could talk about this for hours. I'm fascinated now. Is what are you going to do now? Now that you've reached the unachievable in so many people's eyes, what does Chloe McArdle's next couple of years look like?
Well, I absolutely love sharing my journey, my stories, trying to inspire as many people as possible. And I do quite a bit of keynote speaking into businesses in person and virtually, and even in schools, that's super special as well. So I hope to do more of that and just share a little bit about our sport and inspire people to have a go at open water swimming too. It has so many benefits.
Chloe, you're an inspiration to us all. I couldn't think of any better person to be talking at schools and inspiring young kids to be able to do something with their lives. We're privileged to call you an Australian, and hopefully we can touch base with you soon. We'd love to have you on regularly on Sports Day.
Oh, you guys are so sweet. Yeah, of course. I'd love to chat again. Thank you so much for your time.
You too. Thanks, Chloe. Chloe McArdle there, open water swimmer. And I can't remember speaking to an Australian that I feel more honoured to share a nationality with. That is absolutely phenomenal what she has done.
I think you and I spent half the time shaking our head, like in amazement.
It just doesn't make sense.
I got so many questions.
I know. We actually could have talked to Chloe for another couple of hours. I wanted to ask her, but I would have gone for 15 minutes. The whole pain barrier for her, I'm fascinated in. Like, you would have gone through pain with footy, and, you know, marathon runners talk about when they hit a wall. She's that triple crossing. It's a 10-hour swim one way.
Well, she said she had 30 more minutes. She'd probably be dead in the water.
She is literally swimming herself to death in that triple crossing.
Their ability, those sort of athletes, to compartmentalise.
Yeah, amazing.
So just put everything in different little boxes in your brain, and that's what I'm focusing on right now.
Yep. And she said the only thing you can think of is next stroke. Doesn't matter how quick, doesn't matter how strong, just next stroke, next stroke, next stroke.
Can you... I still don't get the triple crossing. You've gotten all the way across. You've got 10 minutes. And it's like, okay, guess I'm going back.
10 minutes on shore.
I'm going back. And then I'm going to come back again.
I get annoyed if I finish a lap of the 10 and I think about doing a second lap. I usually just stop.
Yep.
More sports after this. Welcome back to Sports Day. We're here for Red Energy, Canstar's most trusted energy retail, and for Wilson Homes. They believe in great design, so you love being home. Sam McClure and Jimmy Bartel with you. A quick sport update. Plenty happening in the AFLW, so we're obviously in pre-season. And a Richmond player has tested positive to COVID-19 over the weekend. The Tigers confirmed that a player returned a positive result after pre-training rapid antigen test. And then they had a PCR test after that. And as per the protocols, that training session didn't go ahead. Richmond then trained Thursday. All of their AFLW players and staff who attended that session are self-isolating and awaiting health department advice. There's going to be more of this because cases are going up, or they're at least quite high, and particularly as of Thursday night, Friday midnight, there's going to be even more people out and about, Jimmy.
Yes, pardon the pun, regarding tests and things like that. It's a good test case, and luckily it happened during pre-season training.
Mm.
So imagine this match day.
Yeah, well, but that might happen.
Yeah, so it's
very possible.
It's good that we get to work out all the kinks now. What happens? What's the process or protocols that we put in place? But have you heard anything? You've got your ear to the ground more than anybody else. Have we heard anything yet from the Players Association regarding mandatory vaccinations?
No, not yet. And I think that
the world is on this. The sporting world is about this right now. It can't be a silent one for Paul Marsh and the Players Association. You need a clear stance.
No, but that, yeah, I agree with that. But the stance will first have to come from the AFL, would it not?
No, it'll be joint because it'll be a Players Association. It's like any other working environment. All unions involved have either pushed it, made it open. You know, they've been clear on where they sit.
Mm.
Why is a Players Association any different?
No, it's not. And, you know, we've already seen the negotiations and what's happened in the NBA with the Players Association there. I think that what we've seen from around the world is that whether you mandate it or not, there is a silent, there's a silent request, I think, from all professional sporting organisations that we would like you to get vaccinated. And if you don't, well,
it's going to be very difficult for you to actually perform.
Ultimately, it's going to be hard for you to be the person and the player that you have previously been.
Yeah, and so that needs to be clear. So the NBA Players Association made it clear. We're not mandatory vaccine.
Yep.
But if you choose not to be vaxxed, these are the conditions. You cannot sit with your teammates on the bench.
And you lose 1/95th of your salary per game, is it?
Yeah, I don't know about that one, but
an ESPN report came out with that last week.
Yeah, there's the way you travel. You can't sit with the team. You have to travel separately. Mm. You have to get tested three times a week.
It's a nightmare.
It's a nightmare. But it's still not saying you have to be mandatory vaxxed.
So we saw Denny Varnhagen, who's a player with the Crows in the AFLW. There was a story in the Adelaide Advertiser today that said she has told the club she's not willing to take the vaccine. So this is where it gets really tricky, or in some people's eyes, the lines get blurred a little bit, because I think, and I'm double vaxxed, I think you're double vaxxed as well, and I know people who don't want to be vaccinated.
Yep.
And there's absolutely no judgment for me. I'm very much pro-choice when it comes to that sort of stuff. However, that pro-choice becomes a little more difficult to argue for when you're in a team environment.
Hmm.
Because someone refusing to get vaccinated when the vast majority of their team, if not everyone else, is getting vaccinated, you automatically isolate yourself, or the situation isolates that person.
Yep.
Because you not being vaccinated makes you vulnerable to the team performing the role that they are paid to do.
Yep.
That's why anti-vaxxers in sport, it makes it really difficult, and particularly in a team sport. If Novak Djokovic doesn't want to get vaccinated, now I'm not saying this is not what's going to happen, and Australia, through the federal government and the state government, Daniel Andrews, say, well, we can't have you here. That ultimately affects him.
Yep.
And his back pocket and his ability to win tennis matches and his ability to break the record for the slams. In a team, if Jimmy Bartel doesn't want to get vaccinated, well, the rest of the team that he's playing for suffers for it.
Hmm.
So this is what we're going to see. And I have no doubt, we've seen it at the AFLW, I have no doubt that there are going to be stories breaking about AFL men.
Yeah, and
players who don't want to get vaccinated.
And I think we're saying the same thing. I'm just waiting to see. We need to hear from the Players Association and the AFL. I'm not blaming either, but we need to know the terms and conditions.
What would be the perfect scenario in your head? Paul Marsh and Gillon McLachlan announce there were a joint media conference and say, we at the AFL are committed to every player and member of staff being vaccinated by the start of next season.
Yeah, I think that'd be leaning towards that way. I can't predict it, but
But that would be the perfect scenario, would it not?
Yeah,
as far as the continuity of the season.
Yeah, a perfect scenario for them from a PR point of view, I guess, would be that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
But I think we all just need to know the NBA Players Association were onto it because they knew the season was rolling around, gave everyone ample time to make their decision whether they be vaxxed or not. These are the conditions for you if you don't want to be. That's your choice. These are the conditions for you. If you do, that's your choice.
Mm.
and it was very clever.
I agree with that. Speaking of clever, our own Zoe is extremely clever. You've seen and heard from her behind the glass on this show many a time. Here she is with a rural weather outlook.
Well, 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 they've finally realised where the talent is in this team and given me an apprenticeship. Yes, it's Zoe from Out the Back debuting this week's weather outlook thanks to Farmers Business Network. Grow your business as an FBN community builder. Jane Bunn, who? Let's have a look at what's going on around the place. Wodonga, rainy week, bar Wednesday when the sun comes out and reaches a top of 23 degrees. Warms up towards the weekend, but then the rain does continue to fall. In Wangaratta, clear skies till midweek, showers increasing at the back end of the week. It's beginning to look like summer in Horsham as we get to a top of 25 degrees on Wednesday. Showers Thursday, dropping to 19 degrees by Saturday. And as usual, beautiful weather across Sunraysia, topping 30 degrees Wednesday and Thursday, dropping down to the mid-20s across the weekend. That was a weather outlook thanks to Farmers Business Network. Become a Farmers Business Network community builder and introduce the future of farming to your community.
Welcome back to Sports Day. We're here for Red Energy, Canstar's most trusted energy retailer, and for Wilson Homes. They believe in great design, so you love being home. North Melbourne are an interesting case study under David Noble. Big improvement in them for season 2022, and Jimmy and I caught up with the man himself a little earlier in the show.
Bloody fantastic.
Dave, we'll get to, I guess, all the coaching lingo and speak, but you spent a lot of time in administration, so I'm going to use one of the great words from sporting administration. Have you any clearer on the protocols ahead if something, like if everyone's double vaxxed but you still get a positive, have you got any indication from the AFL or the Players Association what would happen if even a double vaxxed player tested positive?
Not at this stage, Jimmy. The only thing that I would think is that, you know, the way that it shifted this year particularly, you know, we didn't necessarily have to go into small groups as much as we did the year before. So you would like to think that, you know, maybe with some of that rapid testing, you know, the double vax, as you say, it's, you know, still around the world. There are people that are still, you know, contracting the virus, but obviously not at the level of intensity, you know, if you're not. So I guess we'll just have to play that out as we go, mate. But, you know, I think the governments are trying to get on top of it, you know, being able to get people out of lockdown, in, particularly in Victoria, that's been there for a long period of time, is something that I'm sure everybody's aspiring to get out in a couple of days' time.
Well, let's talk about some bit more exciting stuff in footy. The professor of football, Glenn Luff, he had his phone ringing off the hook to try and get that number one draft pick, especially from the Crows, because they had a South Australian kid right under their nose just dominating SANFL footy. Horne Francis, was there ever a consideration to move the number one pick on?
In my old role, maybe. In my new role, no. oh, look, you from a, you know, a business perspective, you've got to listen. Yep. You know, I think it's just one, it's, if it's in the interest of the club to consider something, mate, then someone's prepared to put something, you know, compelling in front of you. It probably wasn't from either of the two clubs. I'd have to say that wasn't anything that was extremely compelling for us to go, oh yeah, look, that's something that we need to take to the board and consider. From a coach, he's a fantastic player. You know, we're looking forward that if we don't do any dealing in that period of time between now and the draft, we'd love to consider him, I think, at the top end of the draft.
What about the other side of footy? They're the new players coming in. Old players going out, it's never easy. Sean Attlee, no. Trent Dumont, Tom Campbell, Charlie Ham, all being told they wouldn't be offered new deals. Can I just ask you about Sean? 234 games for the club, David. And I guess relative to that, you're an outsider coming in. How difficult is that conversation? All delistings, I'm sure, are really tough. But a guy that's played that many games and has been part of the fabric of the footy club for as long as he has been, are you able to take us inside that conversation?
Yeah, as you say, Sam, they're extremely tough regardless. I mean, you're taking away, you know, people's aspirations and dreams in a lot of cases. And Sean's been, you know, an enormous stalwart of our football club and a very well-loved, you know, player. Particularly internal from a player's perspective, highly valued, highly rated. Look, without going into, I guess, the intimate details, I think it's those conversations that you need to have, you know, ongoing through the year. You know, you can't afford, I don't think, as a person or an individual to get to a point that it becomes, you know, just a shock or you blindside someone from that side of things. So, yeah, there were some ongoing discussions, you know, with myself and Sean in regards to where things were laying. We have to make some changes. We need to continue to grow the list. There's a level of unluckiness in some of those players, and there's a number of them across the competition at every club, mate, where they cycle out of contract, unfortunately, at the wrong time. And, you know, so there's a little bit of that as well. And then there's some tough decisions that we have to make in the assessment of where we're going, how our list needs to build, and how we're going to maintain, you know, opportunity for guys to come through. So there's a number of different elements that go into the overall decision. But, yeah, Sean and Trent, you know, have been fantastic players for our football club for a long period of time.
Dave, you're using a bit of American terminology, your depth chart. Off the back of his year last year, I know no one's guaranteed any position. They're still going to put in the work, but Larky looks to be the key forward there. But you look at your rucks / key forwards, big bananas around 200 centimetres tall. You got young Charlie Cobden. Goldstein was fantastic, and we know he likes to play predominantly ruck. Edwards, the mid-season draft, and then Coleman Jones comes across.
Yeah.
One of these guys is going to probably have to serve a longer apprenticeship as a forward than a ruck.
Yeah, that's probably true. I think the aspect that we liked last year was the fact that every time Goldie went actually forward, he kicked goals. Yep. His time forward for the number of shots on goal, he was probably behind Larks and probably in front of Cam. He was probably our most effective forward.
Great to hear you from David Noble there. Coming up to 8 o'clock, that does us for tonight, Jimmy and I. Huge show. Great to hear from Peter Moody. I still can't get over Chloe McArdle. I really just want to have her on every week, maybe for 5 minutes of just inspire us now. Anyway, we'll think about and brainstorm that segment a little deeper. Jimmy's off. In fact, Jimmy mentally was off a couple of minutes ago. He still can't get over Chloe as well. We'll see you tomorrow, same time on Sports Day.